KCSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Peter Gallison, the Joseph Pellegrino University Professor and Director of Historical Scientific Instruments, at Harvard University in the History of Science Department. Peter is a prolific author, but for what really is the first time on Hearsay Culture, we're going to be interviewing him about a film. And that film in particular is titled Secrecy, a topic that we cover heavily on Hearsay Culture, something that we've talked about the last couple of weeks, which with Peter's colleague Arkan Fung at Harvard, as well as Micha Sifri. And we're going to round out this triumvirate of discussions by chatting with Peter about his documentary Secrecy, which he put together with Rob Moss, who is not joining us. The focus of Peter's documentary, and I'll call it that in shorthand, the focus of that documentary is secrecy, and particularly secrecy in the interest of national security, what that regime looks like and what concerns we might have about it. Now, oftentimes when you view documentaries and when you talk to documentarians, the documentarians naturally have a particular viewpoint that they bring forward, and we're certainly going to discuss that here. But very interestingly, in Peter's documentary, Peter didn't do the documentary in an echo chamber, meaning that he interviewed people who all shared the same view. And it makes the documentary both much more fulfilling and I think much more rewarding by the fact that Peter interviewed not only people in the national security arena, but former CIA officials and other officials who deal with information issues inside government, who had a very different view than other guests and other people interviewed on the show who feel that the secrecy regime is run amok or ultimately is not effective. And so the documentary presents, I think, a very well-rounded view of the questions that we face in 2011, although the documentary was made in 2009, it's certainly just as timely today, about what secrets need to be kept from public view and whether, in fact, secrecy is something that we can maintain and should maintain given the communication changes that have occurred over the last 15, 20 years with the advent of the internet. Now, the documentary was put together prior to WikiLeaks making as enormous a splash as it has, but certainly that's a topic of relevance as well. But here we're going to focus specifically on this documentary, which I found, like I said, very, very interesting as well as very well-rounded. And not to mention, I should also add an unusual topic on the show, but I found the filmography, and particularly the music that underlined most of the documentary to add to this image that Peter and his colleague Rob were portraying of secrecy as being not only murky, but something that should give us pause. So I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to having the discussion with Peter today. Peter's film career, which also includes the film Ultimate Weapon, is only part of what he does. Again, he is the Joseph Pellegrino University Professor and the Director of the Collection of Historical Scientific Instruments in the Department of History of Science at Harvard University. He was also named a John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Fellow, and in 1999 he was the winner of the Max Planck Prize given by the Max Planck School in Germany, which is a well-known prize in the field. His interest primarily is in the intersection of philosophical and historical questions, and he has written a variety of books and volumes and articles in addition to the documentary Secrecy. He is joining us from his office at Harvard via Skype, and we're recording on June 29th. Peter, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start off, Peter, with the question I ask most of my authors, and indeed you being the first documentarian, I can say that as well. Talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in the topic of secrecy.
Well, in my other life, I'm a historian of science, and I think mostly about the development of modern physics from the time of Einstein to the present. And the story of physics over the course of the 20th century, in fact, the story of much of science through the 20th century was very much shaped by a complete transformation in the relationship of science and the state. And that was affected very strikingly during World War II by the development of weapons technologies, in particular radar and nuclear weapons. And around that, around the establishment of these very large projects, what in 1945 dollars cost about $2 billion each, which is when $2 billion was real money. And these created a transformation in the relationship of secrecy to the state as well. Because, of course, there's been secrecy back to the times of the Babylonians and, you know, the Spartans and the Athenians had to hide from each other where their troops were. Secrecy is not new. But in World War II, with these very large techno-scientific projects, you have the establishment of these very large bureaucracies, and the scientists and the universities become enmeshed and engaged with a secrecy system, with the classification system much like the one we have today. And this is a transformation that has intrigued me a great deal, and it's affected the way physics developed and both the prestige and the difficulties that physics has had in the world, its relationship to governments, its really its budgets, its contractual relations between universities and the state. All of these things were changed in World War II. So secrecy became for me something that was woven in and out of my work. I've often had to work with declassified documents, and I became intrigued by what was held back and what was released and what it meant to try to control the flow of knowledge in science, where, after all, in some ways, it's all about establishing, at least at the end product of publication, or some exposure and confrontation between ideas and people. So I came into secrecy through its engagement with science and became interested in the way that what originally were nuclear secrets broadened out to encompass a much, much wider sphere of secrecy in which we now live. And so that's how I came to it, and I began to write about this. I wrote a piece called Removing Knowledge about what the theory of secrecy was, in a sense, and how large the scope of secrecy, secret documents were, that you actually have in more pages classified per year than you have acquired by the big libraries of record. So it's a huge process, and I talked to Rob Moss, my colleague and friend, about teaching a course on filmmaking and science, because this is just after I had made this film that you mentioned before about the hydrogen bomb and the moral political debates over the hydrogen bomb. And we began to think about how we might film this most unfilmable of topics, how we might be able to portray in a way that was engaging a world that is, by its very nature, invisible.
And that leads to the follow-up question, which is why a documentary as opposed to the more typical route that people in academics and academia would take?
I think film can make certain things vivid in a way that print doesn't, just as print can make things vivid that film's not well suited for. If you want to explain complicated relations within a family, a chart might be the best way of doing it. Or if you wanted to have an analytic argument with seven major steps, you can lay that out in print in a very clear way. But making an argument in film with seven steps is an awkward use of the medium. But film can do other things. And in particular, one of the pieces of this puzzle that really interests me is that for everybody involved with secrecy, secrecy is more than simply a bureaucratic affair. It's not just a matter of whether you disclose how high an airplane could fly or what the maximum speed of an aircraft carrier might be. I think that it's even for the people that are high up in the national security establishment, secrecy always signifies something else. And one of the things that was striking in making the film was whether we were talking to opponents or supporters or former spies or analysts or archivists, that for everybody, secrecy carried some other weight, whether it was the weight of biblical secrecy or sexual secrecy or hidden things make us want them tremendously. One of the senior analysts at the National Security Agency remarked, and we used this in the very opening of the film, that secrecy is like forbidden fruit. You can't have it, he says. Makes you want it more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we've come to know that very well in the history of the last few years, where sometimes secret knowledge, which was less good, like that which was produced about the supposed weapons of mass destruction held by the Iraqis, was contradicted by much more openly produced knowledge by the UN, and people tended to believe the secret knowledge. People in government tended to believe it because there's something seductive and powerful about secrecy. So film was a way of getting at some of these other resonances, of getting people to speak about people who were in the system of secrecy, even opposing it or working within it or caught up in it inadvertently, what it meant and signified to them. And so that led us to think about using certain aspects of animation, for example, or to be able to use certain artistic explorations of this idea. Jenny Holzer projected declassified documents against a multi-story building,
mm-hmm.
with huge xenon projectors. And there's something about the visual that allows you to imagine beyond the purely bureaucratic and formal, as well as making very striking the issues that are of analytic and moral political importance.
You know, I recall when I was watching the documentary that I remember seeing the listening station exhibit, which has the digital screens, the multitude of digital, it must be 100, at least 100 of them, digital screens running words across them, and in that way creating a really striking work of visual art. And it does say something about how this information moves, that if you try to actually read the information or read what's being written, you can quickly get lost because you see other words going by on the screen just above it or just below it, which is obviously, I think, a useful metaphor for how information flows towards us. And those are the kinds of things which I could definitely see are better described, and indeed the impact of them is shown much better to a reader or a viewer visually. I'm curious, as someone who writes primarily, what the biggest challenge was for you as a documentarian trying to convey these ideas.
Well, I think that this is the second film I made, and I think that the process for me has been long and hard, and in trying to unlearn certain things that work very well in print media, because film demands other things. For example, I remember when I started doing interviews. I remember one where I asked somebody who was one of the first people to apply a computer to a programmed computer to any serious problem, and it was done to calculate something on the hydrogen bomb. And I said to him, something like, wasn't it astonishing to be able to do this calculation with a machine that would have taken months by hand? And he said, well, it was okay. And in print, I would have been able to edit the response and, figure it using the wonder of the ellipsis and paraphrase to do, the information. And as he went on and to give his answer about what these early computers were like, it would have been fine. But in film, it's catastrophic. You need, everything needs to function at the same time. The visuals got to work, the intonation and inflection. You can't have people who speak in such broken sentences that they're not understandable. Their accent has to be interpretable. You can't subtitle a person speaking in English with a heavy accent. So it's like playing three-dimensional chess compared to the kind of interviews I'd done in that part of my historical work that was dealing with contemporary history. So I think that one of the things, I once lost a fabulous interview because I forgot to have the guy turn off his refrigerator, and it was too noisy. We couldn't use it. So there are many, many things about the pace, and that's just the interview part. And then there's really learning to use the visual to be able to say, why is a certain visual element there? For instance, one of the stories we tell in the secrecy film that's very important is the so-called Reynolds case. And this was a B-29 that crashed over Waycross, Georgia in October 1948. And it had some civilian scientists on board who were testing a new kind of radar set. And the Air Force plane, which was mostly military, but these few guys from the civilians, went down. And several of the civilian scientists were killed. Their families then wanted to find out what had happened. And they applied to the Air Force, and it went through courts. They won. The families won several times, and finally it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Air Force said, no, you know, you can't have this information. You can't have an accident report. It's so secret you can't possibly have it. In fact, the Supreme Court justices, you shouldn't look at this accident report. It's so secret that even the Supreme Court shouldn't cast their eyes upon it. So the Supreme Court said, okay, this is 1953, we won't look at the accident report. And this became the basis for the state secrets privilege, a very important precedent in American secrecy law. And basically, it allowed the executive branch, under which secrecy is essentially located, to say to the courts, stay out, go away. You're not going to be able to look at this. It was originally about a particular piece of evidence, but it's grown over the years to be a method by which the executive branch can simply say, this case is too sensitive to go to trial. And it was used very extensively during the Bush administration, and it continues to be used very extensively by the Obama administration. So in telling this story, it's a combination of legal history, and we talked to some of the lawyers and people who were involved with that, and the ACLU, but also the children of some of the pilots, of some of the civilian radar engineers who were killed, and the wife of Reynolds, who the guy who after whom the case is named, and so that's a mix of rather analytic material. It's establishing a very important piece of law. It's a very human story, and the wife and some of one of the daughters who appears in the film. It's also their lives have been utterly upended and transformed by this event. So it's a very human story, and it's a story with consequences for our contemporary moment. In fact, it's the basis for a story that bookends this one in the film about Khalid El-Masri, a guy who was arrested and tortured. Basically because he had the same name as a bad actor, but he himself had nothing to do with terrorism or anything else. He was eventually released, but when he wanted to bring the case of why he was seized and what happened to him to court, the state secrets privilege was invoked and it was thrown out. So this is that's the kind of dense problem where you have a mix of emotion, analytic legal material, consequences for the present, politics, archival material, all of these combined, and film offers a particularly vivid avenue into that kind of complexity.
We're talking with Professor Peter Gallison, documentarian and co-documentarian of the film Secrecy on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Peter, you in that last answer, you mentioned several topics, and I wanted to delve in a little bit in the show. Interestingly, and we'll get to it later, I found particularly striking that, of course, in the Reynolds case, when the document at issue was finally declassified, it turned out that the document didn't say anything more than what was already generally known, and it, as you point out, a one-sentence reference to secret project or something along those lines without any more details. And so the idea of that document being so sensitive that it couldn't be revealed to the Supreme Court is portrayed in the film as a lie, but certainly at a minimum an extremely dramatic interpretation of what that document actually meant. You you touch on a number of questions in the document, in the documentary, which I want to ask your opinion on, having done the documentary as well as written about these topics. And one of the big focuses you have is the question of who ultimately would make a decision that something should be secret. In the case of Reynolds, it was the government ultimately deciding that no one else could see it. Based upon your analysis and interviewing these individuals and writing on this topic, who should decide what the public should know about government? Can an individual make such a decision?
Well, there's no one super neutral Archimedean point from which we can look down and survey all of the problems of secrecy. But it seems to me the following is true. If you don't have oversight, you're guaranteed going to get into trouble, because unchecked power of that kind by any individual or agency or even branch of government risks people invoking secrecy beyond what's necessary. There are fundamental forces that are at work that drive us to more and more secrecy. They're protecting turf. There's covering up malfeasance. There's extension of power. There's competitiveness between agencies or between among individuals. There are many reasons why people push for more secrecy, including the asymmetry between the fact that no one ever in the history of the universe has gotten fired for overclassifying, but lots of people have gotten fired for releasing things that they shouldn't release. So there's a tendency on all sorts of grounds to increase the amount of secrecy and its scope. And we need to have some oversight. So then the question is, who's going to provide that oversight?
Right.
Well, one of the great failures of that case of that we were talking about, the Reynolds case, was that the Supreme Court simply said, this is too secret, we're not even going to look at it. And as you mentioned in your comment, it was particularly tragic because the accident report, the document in question, had nothing secret in it. Eventually, it was just batch declassified by the Air Force, among many, many other airplane crash reports. And, you know, nothing bad happened. It just had a sentence in it that said secret equipment was tested, and equipment wasn't even all that secret. But there was nothing about the content of the equipment or what the equipment was or what it did or how it functioned or what its specifications were. And when the court didn't take that opportunity to at least read and evaluate this, it passed on something that it shouldn't have passed on. If a court needs special technical assistance, as I'm sure you've discussed with other guests and other times on this show, you can get expert, you know, masters to read the documents. There are judges, you know, if we can't count on the secret-keeping capacity of the Supreme Court, I don't know where we are. You can certainly have documents read in camera, that is to say, not in for public disclosure. There are lots of ways that the courts can handle secrets. They do it all the time. They do it in sexual assault cases. They do it in conspiracy cases involving the mafia. They do it involved in patent law. And they do it in national security cases. We can do that. That's one. Congress needs to exercise some oversight, and both houses have intelligence committees that deal with very classified material, and they need to oversee this and act as a balance. We have something called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created a special court of the similar name, and the executive branch and its intelligence agencies go to it when they want the ability to be able to monitor the activities and do certain classified things. And the court can even act retroactively if it's an emergency. But it's another form of oversight. Just the fact that the executive branch, the CIA or the NSA, has to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court means that they need to have their arguments in order and their documents prepared, and they need to be willing to stand up in front of serious people and explain it. That doesn't mean that oversight will save us, but the absence of oversight is sure to condemn us to a great deal of hurt.
There are multiple layers of decisions, obviously, that go into something being a secret, right? The initial holder of the information has to decide that information should be made public. And then if there's a challenge, of course, then someone has to decide whether that decision was correct. But even before you get to that point, there has to be knowledge that there is, in fact, a secret that's being held. In other words, the old cliche, what you don't know can't hurt you. The question to me, it seems, raised from the documentary is how we get at that first question, how we decide ultimately how we know that there is a secret, as opposed to information which, as some of the people whom you interviewed pointed out, information that if it was made public would actually make us more safe. And so any thoughts on that initial, somewhat theoretical, perhaps even abstract question of what it means to have a secret and how we decide that we have one?
Well, there are two sides of that. One is the content, and the second is the procedure, and they're both interesting. There are certain topics that the government has the right to protect it under law to classify as secrets. So, for example, things having to do with nuclear weapons or cryptographic strategies and the machinery of codes and decoding, diplomatic exchanges. These are examples of things that have fallen to categories that can be made secret. There are other things that can't be. You can't use secrecy. You can't say it's top secret when what you're doing is to try to protect a crime. If somebody, commits an embezzlement or murder, you can't use secrecy to cover that up. And you can't classify things that are already publicly in the record. So there are restrictions on what can be made secret, and there is guidance by law and precedent as to what kinds of things can and should be made secret. Then there's the question of how it becomes a secret. And that's very interesting, because in the beginning, the president is the first classifier, and he designates a group of around 2,000 people are called original classifiers. And these original classifiers can designate something as secret. They can say, it is secret that you need this configuration of plutonium to produce a lightweight nuclear weapon. And then there are tens of thousands of people who are called derivative classifiers, who can then, when they see that information quoted or paraphrased in another document, can say this document is classified in virtue of the fact that original classifiers classified it as secret or top secret or confidential. So this is it's a kind of giant pyramid with the president on top, going down through these original classifiers who were appointed by the heads of the agencies like NSA, CIA, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and so on. And then the people who are derivative classifiers extend that to all the places where this information is used, disseminated, or reproduced. And then there are millions of people who work with under classified conditions, that is to say, they have the right to see and work with classified documents. So it's this huge pyramid. And one of the issues that we've faced as a country over many years is that we overclassify. Now, I'm not somebody that thinks there are no legitimate secrets. I think there are things that I'm very happy are not on the web. I don't particularly want to see, detailed instructions on how to make binary chemical weapons, or exactly what the security procedures are that keep nuclear weapons from exploding. I think those things rightly are kept secret. And there are other things, diplomatic exchanges, where in order to maintain and conclude peace agreements need confidential discussions that go back and forth in the process of those negotiations. Now, that information doesn't have to be secret forever, but it needs to be secret during negotiations. So there are places where we as a country, have a great stake for our physical and other welfare to maintain secrecy. But that said, we overclassify hugely. And this worries even people deep in the most classified parts of the government. So Rob Moss and I spoke to somebody who had been responsible for the security of the United States nuclear weapons. And he was worried that there was overclassification about nuclear weapons matters because it led people to disrespect the real secrets. And if you classify trivial things, then people begin to think that secrecy is a joke and they don't protect the things that really need protecting. A way of judging how much overclassification there is that if you file for Freedom of Information Act request to see a document as a journalist or a citizen, and you're denied, there's an appeals process. And at the very pinnacle of that appeals process is the heads of the agencies or their designees get together in a group called ICECAP, I-S-C-A-P, and they judge these things. And at the highest level of appeal, they release a huge quantity of these previously denied requests. So you know that there's just a tremendous tendency to overclassify, and it worries people both inside the secrecy system, and it should worry us outside of it, because if we don't have access to basic information like why we're going to war, then we as citizens can't exercise the kind of deliberative democracy to which this country is committed.
We're chatting with Professor Peter Gallison, a documentarian. The film is Secrecy on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU-FM, which is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture, and you have a couple of ways, ultimately, that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the show as well as to KZSU. With regard to those decisions, Peter, let's talk about that in a little more detail. One of the interesting points that is also raised by one of your, actually more than one of the people whom you interviewed, is the idea that today, in 2000, I guess 2008, 2009, versus say World War II, there were or even the Cold War, there were parameters. Which I read to mean that there were boundaries or rules for conducting national security and foreign policy issues and making decisions on secrecy. And the implication was that the absence of those parameters makes the decision more difficult. And I wonder what you think about that. You know, in other words, is it conceivable or is it your view that the absence of the parameters actually makes both the import of secrecy perhaps less, maybe, and perhaps gives more flexibility to decision makers who are able, if they are able to think outside the box, to make more fine-grained and granular decisions that allow for perhaps ultimately a better regime of secrecy. Any thoughts on that lack of parameters today, assuming that you think that the lack of parameters exists?
Well, one of the people who talks about this in the film was in charge for many, many years of the Information Security Oversight Office, which is an office that was established in the government to monitor the amount and character of secrecy across all the agencies. And they produce a report every year about how we're doing as a country in declassifying things that need to be declassified and keeping the amount of classification under control. And for the whole history of secrecy up until the last couple of years, the post-2001 era, one of the parameters or one of the limits on secrecy was that we didn't classify infrastructure. It was not like North Korea where you could get into trouble or lots of authoritarian regimes where you get into trouble for photographing train tracks or electrical generating station or something like that. But we now are beginning increasingly to restrict information about that, what the floodplains, for instance, are below a dam, because someone might think, well, if you knew what the floodplain below the Hoover Dam was, you could calculate the amount of damage that would be caused if the dam were to be destroyed. And so terrorists might have an interest in this. But it has tremendous bad effects for us. Like, you know, we suffer in the last years from tremendous flooding and in New Orleans and Nebraska and North Dakota and along the Mississippi. And we need to know the floodplains because the first responders need to know where to go. And so when you start keeping secrets about infrastructure, I think this is a dangerous new area that we've entered. And there's a category now of secrecy that's not in the ordinary classification system, but is restricted. It's information that's not disclosed. And the government in the Bush administration, for instance, requested libraries to destroy documents that they had on their shelves about certain matters of infrastructure. And that worries me. I think this expansion, this is an example of expansion beyond the limits of what had previously been held to be secret. And if you start to think that everything that possibly could be a target for a terrible person, I mean, every gas station and every shopping mall, and I mean, where's the limit? We become a gigantic secret society, and I don't think that's how we want to live. I do think we need to have secrecy, but it needs to have bounds. We need to have good arguments about why certain things should be secret. They should be limited. They should be tested. The courts and Congress and the press and the public need to be constantly challenging the issues of secrecy, because we need to keep it under control, because a lot's at stake. Our democracy is at stake ultimately.
So this documentary, as I mentioned, was made perhaps during the growth of WikiLeaks, but certainly prior to the major releases of information that they have put out. Whether it's the Iraq video showing what appeared to be an attack on civilians, whether it's diplomatic cables, and a few others that have made big headlines. If you were making a documentary today, what would you say about WikiLeaks?
Well, WikiLeaks is, in a way, is the flip side of this expansion of secrecy to, you know, the web and to infrastructure and all of, you know, to really extend the secrecy without end. And WikiLeaks, in a way, is the kind of leak of the 21st century. It's the characteristic form of leaking today. It's not handing a document the way Ellsberg did to the New York, you know, handing over a Xerox copy of the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. It's information extracted in huge quantities, put onto thumb drives or their equivalent, and then loaded onto multiple servers in multiple countries with different sets of laws governing them. It's our contemporary condition, and in a way, I think the particular dynamics of WikiLeaks and, you know, with the fate of Julian Assange is small compared to what's happening much more generally. I think things like WikiLeaks are here to stay. I don't think there's any way that we're going to live in a world where people aren't going to put multiple servers. It's too cheap, it's too easy in a way for it not to happen. Then there are questions about, you know, the specific leaks that WikiLeaks afforded. And, you know, there are dangers associated with WikiLeaks as well. If you have one person in that case essentially making, you know, and a few advisors making judgments about blocks of data that are so large that that person couldn't possibly have read them, then, you know, what does it mean to have that kind of power brought under the supervision of a single individual and their particular choices about which country's secrets should be divulged and which shouldn't, and whether certain secrets are dangerous or not. And I mean, I think people debate, but, you know, if it was the case that, that, you know, Afghan informers were killed, you know, people that were informing to the United States military were killed because of information that was released there, what would we think of that? I mean, these are deep moral political problems. Not every leak is a good thing. And you know, I mean, people try to cover up the My Lai massacre. You want that leaked. And people expose that the security procedures at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan were poor and that the response of the Tokyo Electric Power Company was secretive and hiding things. We want that released. But there are other times when, you know, releases can destroy negotiations in diplomatic circles or kill people who are trying to help the United States. Then, you know, it's a different story. So I think WikiLeaks presents a lot of very difficult questions, but the fundamental fact is that things like WikiLeaks, I believe, are here to stay. I don't think trying to prosecute Julian Assange under some version of the 1917 Espionage Act is going to work, and I don't think that there's any future in trying to stop with these archaic laws, and it's not going to happen. It's part of our world. And you could ask, well, you know, what is some private doing having access to massive amounts of State Department documents? And that's another question.
Well, yeah, and that, you know, and that's part of it too. But before we even get there, we have about 10 minutes left where I start asking what I call the unfair questions, which are questions that you can't answer adequately in the time we have left. So I try to tailor them as much as possible. That point about the law not working is one that I do want to talk to you about. Now, I recognizing that you're not a practicing lawyer, I want to ask your opinion on this. You mentioned that the law wouldn't work, and I'm not asking for the details of those laws, but more broadly, do you think the law is effectively dealing with these issues? Now, obviously, the Reynolds case, as you presented in a documentary, is a stark example of the Supreme Court ultimately, in retrospect, making a questionable decision, and clearly, or it seems at least there's a very strong argument for the fact that the government also misled the court. That's an extreme example, although maybe you think that that's the paradigmatic example of it. How is the law doing here? Do you think that the law, in terms of what it is actually doing on the ground, is effective broadly? And of course, this raises issues not only of national security, but also of freedom of information laws generally. Yeah, what's your general opinion there?
Well, you know, I think there are places where the law really needs fixing, and the state secrets privilege is one of them. The Supreme Court is not going to fix their bad decision. They've had the opportunity. It was brought back, in which basically after the release of this not secret accident report was brought to their attention and said basically a fraud had been perpetrated upon the court. It was misrepresented. They don't want to do it. It's the precedent for too many decisions, and the politics are such that there's no way they're going to go back to revise the state secrets privilege in the Supreme Court. I think that's a lost cause. Whereas Congress, there was an effort, and it continues bubbling along, to change the law in Congress. And they have a proposal that was originally authored by Specter and Kennedy, who unfortunately both are dead. But their proposal was that you would have all sorts of mechanisms to try to keep this in bounds. So the court would need to read documents before they declared them secret under the state secrets privilege. It seems like a minimal thing to ask. If they needed help technically or in other ways, they could get that help through special masters or experts that they called in other capacities. There are ways of paraphrasing information to remove the crucial item. I mean, if the issue is that in the Reynolds report, the accident report, what really went on was that the Air Force hadn't complied with regulations that said they needed to put heat shields in on the engines to minimize the effect of a fire. They hadn't told the passengers how to get out of the plane or how to use their parachutes. The pilot feathered the wrong engine. There were these sorts of missteps and those sorts of things. There was no reason ever why those should have been classified. So I think there are ways through paraphrase, through partial redaction, through the use of special masters and experts to by forcing the courts to actually read things before they derail them, to limit the state secrets privileges to matters of evidence and not to simply make it a get-out-of-court-free card. There are all these sorts of things could be done through law that would make things better. So that's an example of where I think specific reform would help us as a country, and Congress needs to step up to the plate and do it.
Do you see, and I think WikiLeaks clearly has brought this to the fore, it doesn't seem like there's much spirit, certainly, in Congress to fix our laws to allow for more information to be made public, but I'm curious to get your view on whether, in fact, one could actually or can still think about keeping a secret the way that we used to, not just 20 years ago, but maybe even before WikiLeaks. Can we keep secrets in government the way we had in the past? And should governments rely upon the ability to keep secrets going forward?
Well, there are things that need to be secret. I mean, I keep coming back to this point. I'm very critical of overclassification. But
let me ask the question a little bit differently, because I want to be clear. I don't mean to suggest that you're opposed to secrets. I'm curious whether you think that given the technological capabilities that exist today, it's reasonable for governments to assume that information that they want to be kept secret will be kept secret.
Well, I think if the amount of secrecy is kept within bounds, and then you have a chance of being able to protect the truly secret things. When it starts to get out of control in size, it becomes harder to protect. People disrespect it, and it ends up on places like WikiLeaks. So I think that no secret is ever absolutely secure. If more than one person knows it, in order to do anything, more than one person does need to know it. But we should keep the names of people who are doing. Valerie Plame should have had her name protected, but other people too who are risking their lives and the lives of others, both American and overseas, to try to protect us against the use of nuclear weapons as a terrorist device, for example. This is very important, and it should be protected. Their names and identities and movements should be protected. It's one of the things I was so disheartened by the revelation of in the Valerie Plame case, because it was disgusting, really, to somebody who devoted their life to doing something that's absolutely essential, and to have her name hauled out in public, ruining her career, which is one thing, and putting the lives of many others in danger. So I think you can protect secrets. I don't think WikiLeaks is the be-all and end-all. I think it was a particular moment when we had no one really has got a very good way of protecting these networks of information. And we, in a response to the over-compartmentalization of data that was so dangerous leading up to the events of 9/11, people tried to make these networks of information flow very open. And then someone like Private Manning had access to things that he couldn't possibly have used. And that became the source for the WikiLeaks divulgence of that information. But there are ways you can protect networks in better or worse ways. And clearly, the State Department had a very poor effort at doing that. But look, information is going to get out, and cyber intrusion into our data systems is a fact of life. Every agency in the government knows it. We know it in the public sphere through big disclosures like names and information from Sony that occurred recently, and many other such cases. There is no guarantee of secrecy, but certainly if we wildly overclassify, we're not on the right track.
Peter Gallison, a professor at Harvard, a co-documentarian of the film Secrecy. I guess we have a few minutes left, so I'm going to ask a last question. Again, unfair question, but I think an interesting one. Do you have any perspective on corporate secrecy? You know, this idea of open society, that corporations should be held to a standard of greater transparency, is one which is gaining some currency. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on it, as corporate secrecy as a problem.
It's a problem in a lot of ways. One of the ways that it becomes a problem in the matters that we've been discussing is that corporations are not subject to Freedom of Information Act. And things that the government is forbidden from doing, certain kinds of data mining and intrusions into privacy, for example, can be done by corporations, which means that the government can outsource things that it can't do on its own. And so that worries me, that we've extended in many ways the national security matters, pushed it into the corporate sphere, and therefore removed it from the kind of oversight that we worked hard to establish in the governmental sphere, like the Freedom of Information Act. So the Washington Post did a very good series on sort of the private dimension of privatization of national security secrecy, and I thought that was a very interesting sphere. But then the corporate world also has a lot of secrecy that's got nothing, you know, sometimes legitimate, you know, trying to keep their business plans secret from their competitors, that seem fair to me, but other ways in which corporations have acted with impunity in ways that, you know, cover up the things that they've done and that have been very bad. And I think trying to figure out, in an era where so much that used to be done by governments, whether it's fighting wars or running prisons or running schools or many other things, have been shifted over to the private sphere, we do have to think about this. I think in the 21st century, corporate secrecy and government secrecy will be very closely entwined, and we can't think of them as entirely separate.
Peter, thank you for joining us today on the show. For those that want to learn more about your work and certainly perhaps pick up a copy of the documentary Secrecy, where can they go?
Well, we have a site, secrecyfilm.com, and if you go there, you can find out more and download some pieces about secrecy that I've written, and you can find out there are reviews of the film and other things. If you're interested in copies for teaching, for instance, you can get copies there. If you're interested in streaming it, you can look on iTunes or on Netflix, which both stream the film Secrecy. And if you're interested in getting a DVD privately, you can write me at the History of Science Department at Harvard, and or email me but you'll find me easily on the web. So I'm the only Peter Gallison with one L, so that should be easy.
Peter Gallison, professor at Harvard and co-documentarian of the film Secrecy. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I'll invite you back for further discussion down the road. But thank you for joining us today, and I look forward to following your work as it progresses.
Thanks so much for inviting me to the program.
I'm happy to mention several guests that are coming up this quarter on KZSU's schedule. Among them, Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air, Professor Marcus Boone of York University, discussing his book In Praise of Copying, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of the book What Technology Wants, Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China, Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University, discussing her book Privacy in Context, and rounding out the quarter, Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU. You can also stream the show live at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can get the show by podcast by going to Stanford's Center for Internet Society's iTunes page or our webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can also go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, is feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. And I do welcome them, as I am going to be in the process through the month of July in booking guests for the fall quarter, which should begin in late September. So I would welcome any suggestions for people that should be on the show or thoughts that you have. So again, it's dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.